I'm EJ Scott, and I'm the curator of the Museum of Transology, the world's largest collection of trans objects being exhibited at the moment at Brighton Museum and Art Gallery.
I'm Annie Brown. I'm an artist and activist working in London, focusing primarily on sexual and gender liberation, also volunteering with Genders Intelligence, doing some youth work side of things there.
I'm Jay Stewart. I'm the Chief Exec of Genders Intelligence. We set up in 2008. We're 10 years old this year. And we do lots of work improving the lives of trans people, young trans people in particular. And our aim is also to increase understandings of gender diversity.
We have in front of us two newspaper articles found in the archives here at the British Library that are really quite extraordinary. One's from 1833 and another one from the Tamworth Herald in 1901. And maybe a good place to start when we're thinking about them is to think about what's happening in them and whether or not we think that they're about trans lives.
Mm. Mm.
This one here from 1833, the Sussex Advertiser, close to my heart, relates a story of Eliza Edwards, who died at the age of 24, and according to the Sussex Advertiser, the following extraordinary circumstances unfolded, because when she was deceased, no one claimed her body, so it was sent to Guy's Hospital for dissection. And upon being sent to the hospital, it was revealed, according to the journalist, to be that of, and I quote, a perfect man. How terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Can we look back into the past and think of this person as trans when there's evidence here throughout the article that they lived their entire lives as a woman and indeed their name is Eliza Edwards?
I think that really comes down to a context question, really, because of the language that existed within sort of British society in the 1830s. I think it's hard for us to implicitly say this was a trans person with our vocabulary and trying to put an identity that we can relate to on something that at the time wouldn't have been the same question or the same sort of words to apply. However, the sort of experiences I would definitely say are ones that in today's vocabulary we would easily associate with that of a trans woman or a non-binary feminine person.
I agree. What do you
think? Yeah, I agree. I agree. I thought that was very, very coherent. It's absolutely right. You know, we can't, you know, how do we look into the past? What language do we use? What stories do we look for? I think we were talking earlier about how it's difficult to even locate these stories, because if you've searched for trans or transgender, nothing would come back at you. So, you know, the archivists have their challenges in terms of locating stories. And yet here we have a narrative that is very evocative and very, relevant and has relevance to stories that we have, in 2018. So I thought it's really interesting. I really like I think it's worth unpacking this idea of a perfect man, because I think that's a bit of a innuendo around genitalia and how the emphasis on genitalia continues, I think, still now to be given far too much attention and importance. But we have moved on, haven't we? And there is some different thinking around, we would hope, certainly in London, in the UK, in England, that someone who described themselves as Eliza, lived as a woman, would be identified as a woman and treated as a woman. And that self-identity is something that's becoming more understood. Mm-hmm. And I think we've still got more work to do, but it's certainly understood. And yet also we have media articles that then position us back into, you know, what genitalia we have and what that means.
That's what resonated with me. I think there is still absolutely a continued narrative that is the spectacularization of trans lives and bodies and trying to disprove our gender identities by undressing us in a public realm. And indeed, she's put on show in front of a group of people who examine her. And it's not till right at the end of the article, and it's a sizable article, as, you know, trans spectacularization, it makes good reading, doesn't it? Good news, sells papers. Right at the end, we've got this comment that one of the jurors said that they considered it disrespectful not having in attendance the medical gentleman from Guy's Hospital. Said the doctors hadn't even arrived.
Yeah. And they had several different stages of talk about how we're going to expose this body that we've found with its extraordinary circumstances and ways of trying to find the next level of people who need to get involved in just a dead woman as we read, or a dead man as they read.
Yes. I think it also resonates with the personal fear I have of dying with dignity. And I don't hear a lot of talk about that in even within trans circles and trans communities. We're just growing up in the public insofar as tackling social oppression that we do face already. So key things that do come on the agenda might be education, for example, and the incredible work GI does. Things that we're not quite up to yet, I feel like dying with dignity is one of them.
I would definitely agree with that. I think there is some thinking, because we know we've got an older population, a growing older population, and so what does that community look like? And I think there are organisations that are thinking about LGBT people, but I think even being trans in those services is challenging. And certainly, I would say, being a trans person, an older trans person who is looked after by carers, would make me feel quite uncomfortable in terms of what do they understand about, and how can they be respectful of my trans identity and my body and my relationship to my body. I think generally, you know, respect and understanding and thinking about the human rights agenda is something that we need to broaden out to. Sometimes trans equality can look quite technical, but if you broaden it out and think about human rights agendas, these are the things that I think we could be focusing on. And actually the way that she was displayed is, you know, even in death. So dying and death perhaps is slightly different themes, but even in death. And it made me wonder, because her body wasn't claimed by a member of her family, how many trans people there were who actually did have a burial where no one then knew that person was, if we're going to call those people transgender, only in the ones that then get kind of belong to the state or to belong to institutes where this exposure takes place. I guess it just signals the invisibility of trans lives in our past or in history.
And so that leads us back to this idea of identifying trans lives retrospectively. Mm-hmm. I actually feel like it is absolutely correct to do that when we're faced with evidence. This article, for example, outlines clearly that she had lovers, had always only ever been known as Eliza amongst you know, people who knew her in her professional world as well. She was a performer. So all of these things say that she lived her life as a woman and clearly identified. I don't know how to look back retrospectively without using the language I have. And I wonder about this argument that we can't say people were trans because it's a modern word. I wonder if that's not, again, part of a difficult, you know, leaning towards erasure. In actual fact, I don't see how I'm meant to understand the past if I don't use the terminology I know.
Yeah.
We're not scared of, I'm going to be controversial here, but we're not scared of using the word lesbian in the past, not scared of identifying gay lives in the past and gay subcultures. I wonder where this fear of the trans past, why it manifests even around our language, you know?
I think that's really spot on. I think maybe you're right. We could kind of maybe, you know, grab the ball by the horns and kind of like claim it and own it and say, yeah, that is, you know, these are our histories, these are our stories, they resonate with us, and trans is a useful word. It makes me actually think of the word cisgender, because at the moment there is a debate around people describing themselves as cisgender, or whether that's a word that is put on people and their kind of reticence to take on that word. And one of the narratives I kind of counter to that when we deliver kind of educational programs and training to staff is the history of the word homosexual and the history of the word heterosexual, and how we do need language to describe who we are. Mm-hmm. And usually the words that come first are the words which are outside of the norm, mm-hmm. which are othered. So you would have a trans person or you'd have a homosexual because that is the difference. Mm-hmm. And yet it takes a little bit of time for then to expose the norm and label the norm, in which case we would say heterosexual, which is the assumption that everyone is, or cisgender, which is, you know, to be identified as the gender you were assigned at birth. So language is always, I think language is always political. It's always about who says what rather than what the words are themselves. You know, it may be, just to think about your controversial kind of point, it may be in my mind great when trans people claim those people as trans, but maybe if they weren't trans, if they were institutes, or I don't know, maybe we would have a different viewpoint. I'm just kind of wondering that. And I think also the thing about trans, a little bit like lesbian as well, or gay, is that
I didn't mean to make such a crass comparison,
but but I think there is slippage, and I enjoy that slippage between gender and sexuality, or LGB and T, and it could be that, you know, could we describe this person as queer or as gay, you know, as homosexual, like, because, as you know, and there are other words as well, aren't there, like maybe in Victorian times, like invert or other words that, and I think we shouldn't discount those things as well, and we use the opportunity to open up how we might consider these people or this person differently, in three dimension, with complexity, rather than pinning them down.
Yeah, I think it's actually very interesting, because archives themselves, and it makes sense to talk about this while we're sitting in the British Library, archives themselves are entirely binaried, if you like. They don't cope with slipperiness. And so when transness itself is inherently slippery, how do you put it in a box for people to find? And so herein lies the complexity of thinking about trans lives in archives. But I don't think that having co-narratives and complex archives takes up more room of one over the other. You know, I don't think we're in any way, shape or form a threat to writing out butch lesbian herstory by considering trans male history. These are co-narratives, and surely the importance of the past is how it informs our sense of self today, and gives us a perspective to look forward, you know, learning from looking backwards. And so I see those sort of the co-narratives as really exciting. You know, it's the Venn diagram of experience. I don't know.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think it allows you to sort of delve into these topics even more, because you're looking at how people existed without these labels. And in modern life, we very much live with these labels placed on us, placed on ourselves. But we're looking at cases where, without any sort of concise idea of what label this person might have taken today, we're able to explore the themes and try and sort of assess that context that they were in and how we can relate to that now without erasing what that was to them then.
And I think it's pretty clear what it was to them then, surely. Am I imagining it? No, I don't think so. Because here in this article from 1901 in the Tamworth Herald about, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we never find out, Mr. Curtis Bennett said that for some reason or other, she had practically led a life of fraud and since the age of 15 had been passing herself off as a man. This is Catherine Coombe. We actually don't find out Catherine Coombe's lived name,
no,
do we?
No.
Right? So Catherine Coombe's male identity has been completely and utterly erased in this media, whereas Eliza keeps being called Eliza.
And yeah, as well as a couple of other names that they sort of imply are characters that she lived by.
Lavina Wallstein.
Great names.
Amazing names. Amazing names. So in the case of Catherine Coombe, they were a prisoner, still living, charged with obtaining money by false pretenses. They had personated manhood, meaning impersonated manhood, for 40 years. Working class, worked as a captain's cook on a P&O liner and a painter and decorator with West End firms, without her real sex ever being discovered. Interesting that they're navigating very typical male occupations at a working class level, physical. Hard work, you know, labour-wise. Whereas we've got Eliza here performing and being stage entertainer.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I always think that there's a kind of, you know, trans people get it in. I always say trans people get it in the neck both ways. In the one sense, you know, we kind of challenge the heteronormative, gender normative kind of pressures that are placed on us, and on the other hand, through transition, the dominant narratives that come out of trans lives are the ones that reinforce the gender norm. So like you just said there, you've got a masculine person who is, you know, carrying out masculine jobs and all the rest of it. So I think those kind of narratives are still dominant in today's press.
Yeah, but do you know what I think it really says? My humble opinion. I think it just says that we're normal people getting on with their lives. And 9 times out of 10, you know, a bloke does a bloke's job.
Yeah, you know,
and that's not actually reflective of that trans person impersonating binary norms.
No,
in actual
exactly.
fact, that's the world we live in. Surely that's a larger critique of patriarchy and the structures.
That's what I mean, like trans people, that is focused on a trans life as if we should be doing something else when exactly the challenge should be everybody who's reinforcing gender norms, and how can we shift culture and our thinking to not reinforce these norms.
You're
absolutely.
Either too much or not enough. There's
never
that.
It's like you can't bloody win.
Again, it makes it difficult to locate trans lives retrospectively. One of the reasons we are missing in historical narratives and particularly on museum walls is because one of the safe places for people to work was in the entertainment industry. This has always been a place that has welcomed queer lives into the fold. And so being in entertainment, you are naturally seen to be an impersonator, an imposter. You're taking on a character role. And so for trans people within those realms, you know, there's automatically this suspended belief, both of the spectator, but of their lives, surrounding their lives as well, you know, in the audience and of them as people in reality. But it means we're doubly missing them, because this is a part of the world that they would have existed in and could earn money in and could live safely in. And indeed, Eliza goes on tour, doesn't she? Appeared in Norwich for the first time in the character of Isabella. Good old Norwich. It's always had a queer underbelly, hasn't it? but it's interesting that, you know, multiple names being attached to this character. We're so lucky in a way that this really, really, really invasive, terrible thing that has happened has resulted in this report for us to be able to find her.
Mm.
It's the irony.
Mm.
Yeah. I think it's interesting what you're saying about the sort of performative way that the being within that sort of industry allows you to be more expressive with these sort of things, because with Eliza, it does say that she at times passed as male, at times passed as female, whereas with Catherine Coombs' story, it's a very rigid story of trying to fit in and not sort of be seen by anyone as anything other than who they are. Mm. So I do find that very interesting, the way that the more sort of expressive industry would allow you to perhaps drop in and out of either being stealth or, you know, showing yourself as your gender identity, and what that might sort of imply about how people would read you if you were being seen as, I'd say, would sort of explain it, someone in the other sex's clothing, but how you would live in that sort of situation where you might be passing or not, and how you would build your life around that, create the sort of circumstances where that could be accepted, which, you know, that's the sort of thing that trans people still go through today, where the sort of areas where I'm going to be accepted, and we can see that in this circumstance someone's done that through being very expressive with it, and in another circumstance they've done it through being very closed off about it. And I don't think you would think of such diversity in within sort of 70 years of some queer roles being very expressive with it and others being so guarded off.
Yes, and again, we're coming to a very current and relevant issue that, you know, non-binary lives are part of our trans experience as well. That, I mean, certainly at this time, very little access to healthcare, to any opportunity to transition medically if you desired. So, you know, passing is a can of worms in so many different ways, if that's what you wanted to do. But then maybe it's also what your identity is. It is non-binary and fluid and flexible. And so, again, this slipperiness of how we locate ourselves in the past, you know, and the challenges that that gives to us. But it still doesn't detract from the fact that I think that this archival evidence is incredibly rich and valuable to us as trans people today.
Mm.
It makes me feel like I've got a past.
Yeah. No, I when I was reading this one and sort of thinking of the areas where Eliza had been living and walking around and thinking, I've been walking around these streets myself in this site 200 years ago. And, you know, I think there's a lot of discussion around trans identities being a new thing, that's something that's just sort of become trending with Tumblr and, you know, to see grounded experiences of people living where I live, having the same experiences, but in a completely different time. It really goes to show that the trans journey didn't start with liberation. It didn't start with sort of the past couple of decades. It's been consistent throughout. It's not just a phase for any period of time.
And it's why I'm so deeply concerned that we don't appear in museums, you know, that we're not written into the narratives and that we've been overlooked, because by overlooking those narratives, so many of them are lost. By neglecting them, they're lost. And if you don't see yourself in a museum, it's to be told that your life doesn't matter, that you don't exist, that you've come from nowhere, that you're a hoax, you know, that you're a falsified construct. It's just, you know, you go to a museum to learn about who you are in the world and where it's come from, and to find answers. And if you can't find them in there, where are you left? What are you meant to think about yourself? What are your parents meant to think about you? What are your kids meant to think about you? What are your friends? Everyone. It museums where, you know, you find sense in the world, I find it deeply troubling. And this kind of evidence validates me.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because I think there is also, I think you're right, invisibility is devastating, but then what is visible? What do we see? And how useful is that for the museum goer or for me as a trans person entering a museum or an archive? And I'm enjoying this conversation because we're trans and, you know, generally these things are looked upon and interpreted by people who perhaps aren't trans or aren't always trans or may not access those items in the same way as we might do or I might do. And I think there is a politic, though, around the representation. So let's say, yes, we want representation, but also what is represented to us, and is it ever anything other than depressing?
Yeah,
because sure. These are pretty depressing, hey, you know?
Sure.
And so that's also very powerful and has impact, doesn't it, on your everyday. So I think, again, the interpretation, the context, the live discussion around the past objects are also important. Because we wouldn't want someone to go, oh my God, it's devastating to be trans, like coming in reading this.
Oh, and then is.
Do you know what? We know different. I know, it's like the best kept secret, isn't it?
Try it, you might like it.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, it's something to hold on to as well.
There are associations here with conversations around it. I mean, in 2017 we marked the 50-year anniversary of the decriminalisation of partial decriminalisation of homosexuality in Britain and Wales, and it's a grim irony that we know so very much, well, you know, reasonable amounts of our gay past because of criminal records.
Yeah,
you know, this is what has allowed an understanding and us to actually trace these men and their lives and where they were and why they were arrested and what evidence there is. Evidence is the actual word, you know, whereas lesbian invisibility is precisely because, you know, one of the many reasons, because they weren't criminalized, you know, because women can't have sex or sexual desire. Yeah. So it's in line with that. You know, that it's these medical reports or, again, criminality that's giving us some insight. The sensationalised media and the cis gaze is what actually is giving us. But, I mean, there are obviously people missing. It's really interesting to see this working class character here because that's obviously one of the voices that gets lost.
I wanted to talk a little bit about economy because I think that's a good point. And it is around class, but it's also around maybe a kind of gender politic, a feminist politic. Because, again, is this person trans? Is a good question. Or, you know, how might we approach these narratives and how might we consider this story in all its complexity? And I think, you know, I think there were... you know, there's an argument this person might say that they're a lesbian or that there's something going on there within a lesbian history. But also, what was the access to earning money if you were female-bodied or assigned female at birth, you know, and we need to sort of consider those things. And I think your point around aren't people just getting on with their lives is probably a good thing to come back to, because I think it is about livable lives, isn't it? What is possible within your context or within your set of circumstances? And we can't take money out of the equation, can we, and access to work and surviving, really. So who knows how this person would describe themselves?
I think what's really interesting following on from that a bit is the way that within this one about Catherine Coombe that they go into detail about his marriage and the fact that I think they say he married three times, or I might have got that somewhere else, but it sort of talks about this being their identity, their life, and I think it's actually quite assuring in the way that it does really back up this, you know, it's almost like you're going to the doctors trying to prove your trans identity. You need to show this support of information of how you've had a trans identity for this element of your life and how it's supported in this element. And I think whether it was the intention of the journalist or not, they've sort of conveyed this whole lived life rather than a sort of moment of sexuality being expressed in whatever sort of terms they might suggest.
The way you described it was like, you know, trying to apply for a gender recognition certificate. It is. They both strike me as being full lives, even if Eliza was only 24. You know, there's description of the trans experience being lived.
But I think that's right. Isn't it so interesting? Because I think there is an emphasis on consistency of gender identity. And we are, as trans people, required to, I think, from the medical kind of model of trans, but also from broader, to be consistent in our gender expression, and that, you know, and to be consistent with the words that we're using. And actually, you know, I think we're gently edging towards a more fluid approach to gender, and some of the discussions around the amendments to the Gender Recognition Act are very much around self declaration, self-identification, but also we need to go further to think about, well, the law just wants us to be one thing or the other at the moment, but what does it look like if we, you know, if we multiply or kind of are more plural in our idea of gender identity?
I think it really comes from sort of the rigid binaries set through imperialist mindsets that we get. Like, both of these obviously are under a huge imperialist context, but if we look further and we go into other countries that are affected by British colonialism and sort of look at their gender history and what that was for them, and it still exists in other communities today, but British colonialism really tried to erase any idea of other ideas of how gender should be constructed. So, for instance, Two-Spirit, or is it Desi or Desi? All different ways of looking at gender, though we might, again, I'll go back to language, we might use in our language, these people are trans. For them, that's not the whole of it, because the way that gender was built up from the very bottom was totally different. So the binaries that sort of applied to us now and people here have gone through this sort of colonialist mindset of how can we enforce masculinity, particularly white masculinity, as the boulder, the strength that everything should be compared against.
I couldn't agree more. It's complex, and we see it being played out across our own trans communities as well. The multiple and complex struggles that you know, our QDPOC communities, for example, go through to even find space within our own communities, but then multiply that again within the media, within the workforce, within education, and so on. And it's being played out and replicated in the modern day, just as we see it here. And of course, we're looking into the past only through the structures that are given to us. And this is mainstream, spectacular media.
Don't forget the headline, the woman in man's attire. It's not that undifferent to what we see today, is it?
Really, really interesting speaking with you both. I think we all agree that many of the issues in here still resonate with us today. And that taking the time to look back and consider it closely and thoughtfully doesn't necessarily bring us closer to any definitive answers, but maybe that's really, really well aligned with the trans experience itself.
only really, yeah, exactly, to really consider that these two people were people, you know, and this, imagine the life that they lived. You know, it does humble me, and it's emotional, you know, I think, to really consider that lived experience, which is, you know, something we need to be thinking more about, rather than thinking about gender in the abstract.
Yeah, I think it's definitely very grounding to see these interpretations of just people living their lives. I'd love to be able to find sources of these people's actual lives rather than their sort of court appearance and their death. To really sort of flesh them out as people that existed rather than media sort of spectacular stories. But no, it's really really sort of brings a story to the trans movement of, you know, this only goes so far, this only goes back to 1833, of someone talking about a death. How much more is not written about, and it just goes on. It just goes on, I think.
There's more to uncover, isn't there?
Thanks to the British Library for saving it for us and for having us here to talk about it today.